Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, folks, welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. I got turned on to our next guest in 05 after hearing a record called Heavy. And there's a track on there called Like Butter that changed me. I think it changed my DNA as a guitar player. I was hooked immediately. So early on when this show, the concept of this show was that it was going to be on Sirius Radio, and right as we were delivering it to Sirius, they were in the middle of their merger with XM, so it didn't happen. It looks like it may happen in the near future, but it didn't then. But in those early demos to Sirius, there was certain tracks like Butter that were on the demos to Sirius, along with another track called Mopey. That was a go-to track for us. So, folks, I want to tell you to say that I'm actually a little nervous, and I never get nervous before interviews. I'm super excited to have with us Mr. Jim Campolungo. How are you, sir?
I'm really good. I'm really flattered. I'm nervous now too. You know, and you picked, you know, I love that track Like Butter. And it's not something I hear about a lot. I mean, when you said it was released in 05, gosh, I think it was my fourth record. I'm, you know, plugging my 12th record.
Yeah.
And I am so proud of that track. You know, it was about as close to, you know, completely realized as any track I've done. And in no small part to the group, of course, and what Joe Goldmark on steel played on the bridge. Mm-hmm. He interpreted a melody I had for that. And of course, he made it three times better. But the producer, Darren Roven, really got the most out of the group. And we had a couple rehearsals and honed in on the drums. I think we were going, I mean, it's giving the audience who hasn't heard this track of the wrong impression, but kind of a John Bonham thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the guitar sound was great, and it also, not to go on and on about it, but it was also a breakthrough for me, because the Darren insisted that I had nothing worked out, because on the two earlier Cat records, a lot of the tunes I would work something out, not all of them, but some. because, you know, we didn't have any time, you know, mm-hmm. and I was probably very conscious of the budget, and I didn't want to go there and not have it, you know, yeah. and that's was so scary to me. And, you know, when the clock's running and people are watching and you got headphones on and maybe you don't love your sound and, blah, you know, fill in all the blanks. And that record, he was like, no, you're going to come in and you're just going to play and wing it. And I said, okay. And he knew me very well. He engineered the first couple records and I trusted him, you know. And, you know, it's like a director, you know, and you're an actor and who you trust the director to get the best out of you. And he really did. And I love that solo and that yeah. track. And it was really recorded from beginning to end, you know, and you know, it isn't perfection, you know, but it works. It was successful. So I'm really, really pleased you picked that one. And Mopey, I didn't think anybody even knew that song. That's off a really obscure record, Life at the Denord. Mm-hmm. So thanks. You really, you know, I'm impressed and flattered, of course.
Well, I'm like, from that moment on, I immediately went and got everything, all the back catalog, and just kind of immersed myself in it over the last 10 years or so. And early on, when I was planning this show, I was like, okay, this is one of the guys I want on this show. But I waited as long as I had. I mean, the show's been around now for 6 years in this form. And I waited this while so I would have a big enough audience to say, hey, check out this guy.
Well, thank you. That's really, really lovely.
Well, I did that with a handful of people that, you know, were really important to me sonically, and from a songwriting standpoint too. I mean, the incredible counterpoint that you do in a trio is really, really amazing and fascinating. And I think you're lucky and also pretty masterful in the way that you pick musicians to play with. That you enhance them, they enhance you. Sometimes in a guitar based situation, it doesn't always work that way. It's usually the guitar player who's just way out in front, and there's not this lovely you know, folding of tone that's happening. With you, you seem to do that. Has that always been a conscious effort for you, or is it just kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, my bassist Chris Morrissey once said, and it was during we were filming this video, and that was it's on YouTube called Camp Along Go After Dark. It was this little series Rockwood Music Hall was kind enough to produce, and I really learned from it. And one of the things Chris said, yeah, Jim, he goes, he just trusts us. It's like if somebody just gave you his car keys. And yeah, and I remember I was sitting there, I think I was off camera, and I just smiled. I thought, well, what a great way to put it. I never thought of myself being that, you know, generous. But, you know, it's kind of how I think, I guess, and in part, it goes back to, you know, the Stone Age, when I was like taking a horse to work and playing at this restaurant named Gordon's in San Francisco right before I moved to New York. And it was this gig where I had done it as a quartet, and we were kind of in the corner and kind of people didn't really pay any attention. And I really like that sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, it's part of living in a vibrant city is having those kind of gigs where you can play and people don't really pay any attention and don't know who you are, and you can work on your craft. Mm-hmm. You know, some people might think of it as, you know, the end of the line, or they'd be cynical about it. But it was one of those gigs where we could play, and the owner, Gordon, loved us, and, you know, the food was great, and we'd play. But at one point, I couldn't get a fourth member, and I started doing it as a trio. And the first gig, we played maybe 3 hours. I mean, it was a long gig where you'd really get inside the music. And I was trying to play all this stuff and playing, you know, oh boy, here, this is C major 7 to D minor 7 to, you know, E flat diminished 7. Okay, boy, I don't hear that. I better try and play it. And I did it again the following week because we played there almost every week. And I learned after, like, into the second hour, the less I play, the better it sounds. And the more I relax and listen, the better it sounds. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from that, I not shortly after that, I moved to New York and was lucky enough to meet Dan Reeser and Tim Lunsell, and kind of they helped define kind of what I do. I mean, maybe not to the point of, like, let's say Santana and his first early records, those guys like Mike Shreve and Greg Rawley and all those guys really defined the Santana sound, and then he ran with the ball. I don't know if it's to that degree, but they certainly were important. And from that point on, you know, I really thought, like, okay, if I'm going to play less, like, what's going on when I'm not playing? So, you know, that's part of my goal is whoever I play with is something that's, you know, legitimate when I'm not playing. And, you know, it's not the kind of band, I don't play the kind of music that's just, hey, bassist, play ding, 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 you know, it's a little more than that. So, yeah, and I've been really lucky. And especially, I mean, not especially, because everyone I've worked with has been like a gift from God, you know, really. But Josh and Chris, you know, we've been playing together 5 years, and I mean, I'm still excited to see those guys. If we get a road trip gig, we're happy because we can talk and catch up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like still feels like puppy love, mm-hmm. and you know, that's really nice. So, and I'm glad you noticed, because those guys are great, and so has been, you know, really all my bands. I've been very lucky that way.
Yeah, and you know what's also cool I noticed too is, so you can watch a lot of YouTube with you guys, and you guys are very physical as well. I don't know if you even realize, you ever go back and watch these videos, you guys are really physical. The three of you are so physical and you know, and you're so lost in the moment, which is, that's what it's all about. You guys contort in all these ways, and it's wonderful.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I was watching about 6 months ago. I had the sound off on, and somehow in the thread, you know how YouTube goes from one to the other.
Yeah.
Like one of my videos came up, even though I wasn't planning on watching myself that particular morning, and the sound was off for some reason. And I looked up and I saw us, and I thought, you know, we look like marionettes on a string, like you know. And not to mention Josh Dion. I mean, you know, the drummer, who's so animated. And what's great about those guys is every now and then we rehearse, and we just do it here in my New York apartment. And Josh at the most brings a snare. Chris will play through one of my Fender amps. You know, it's very low volume. And I look up, and those guys look exactly like they did when we played at Rockwood Music Hall or opening for Wilco, you know, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just how they are, you know.
Right.
So, but it's true. Yeah, it is kind of a physical band in a sense.
Yeah. So you were talking earlier about, you know, you grew up in San Francisco area, right? And I'm a firm believer that geography has a lot to do with, you know, the DNA of the player and how they become who they are. But when you left San Francisco, you said you came to New York. I'm an ex-New Yorker myself, born and bred. And I was curious to know, when you came to New York, did the vibe of the city influence what you were going? I mean, the actual, because New York is an animal. It's a beast. And did it affect you in a way that inspired your songwriting?
I've been like biting my lip for 20 seconds to yell out absolutely. you know, it absolutely infected my music. The city and also the players. I mean, there's so many reasons for it. You know, I'll try and hone it down, but one is that there's nothing like, you know, one, if anybody really wants to be alone, you know, come to New York City. You can really be alone here. You know, it's like being in a Grand Central or something. Yeah. You know, like, you can really be alone sometimes in the most crowded places.
Yeah, it's true.
And when I moved here, I just felt like an amoeba, you know, in a bloodstream. Mm. And it was hard for me because in San Francisco, it's a little city. You know, I was known these are kind of really not the reasons. There's just a general vibe here. But for example, if I went to a guitar store, it was my bros, and I could say, hey, I got a gig on Friday, can you get my amp fixed? And like, all that went away here. Mm-hmm. And you're just like a silent amoeba walking through the subway steps and be on the right side and fall in line. And, you know, there's this anonymous thing that happens. So when you play, it's kind of like a moment to be alive. You know, and it's also difficult. Like, I mean, I love the city and I don't want to paint, like, and you know, it's difficult and it's wonderful, all at the same time. You know, you hate it and love it at the same time sometimes. And, but it was, I don't know, like, it was like somebody lifted off a veil when I played. And people were looking at me and noticing me. And I so felt that. And not to say like gigs in San Francisco weren't special or anything like that, but it's like a totally different thing here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it kind of makes you deliver and be a little, I think it's, you just play a little more intense. It's like being mute for a week or two and then speaking for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and so I know that affected the music, and I know playing with Dan and Tim and just the guys I played with, like, it was so serious, but yet it wasn't cynical. I mean, I remember, and again, I'm not dissing San Francisco because I have friends there like Mark Baum and, you know, just great musicians that I learned so much from that are beautiful people. But sometimes, like, I felt like sometimes there'd be a misery contest a little, like, hey, I'm playing like this really stupid wedding on Wednesday. And, well, man, I'm playing like an even more stupid wedding on Wednesday, you know. And when I got here, it was like people really were, you're here to play. And I never felt that cynicism. I just felt like a gratitude that, okay, I trudged through the snow, my feet are wet, you know, I carried my amp, or I carried my snare and cymbals. Here I am. I am not taking this for granted.
Right.
And, you know, and I learned from that too. I mean, you aren't pulling up in your truck and unloading, you know, your two fender twins. You know, it's like, it's a little harder here. So it made me appreciate whatever I was doing. And I was kind of cut out of that cloth anyway, because I mentioned, you know, that restaurant gig at Gordon's. I always look at most playing situations as an opportunity to work on my craft, whether it's in front of a lot of people who might have some expectation or people that are just more concerned with Sunday brunch. And I don't do that anymore. It feels like those gigs have vanished a little, or maybe I don't know. You know, I don't do that as much. And sometimes I wish I was. But yeah, my music really changed when I got here.
Yeah, I always likened New York to wherever you played and whoever you played to. It was like the entire city had its arms folded and it said, "Okay, show me." Mm-hmm. You know, and because of that, it would really strengthen your resolve, and you'd be like, "Oh yeah, okay, here I come." You know?
Yeah, I've noticed. I mean, when I got here, I just appreciated that the audiences got it, and they got it on a high level way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and And I really appreciated that. But I have to say, last year, which isn't that far away, it was in October, a couple months back, we played Chicago, Minneapolis, and Nashville. And everyone loved us. You know, I mean, not to sound full of myself, but in particularly Nashville was like, gosh, it was like one of the greatest gigs of my life. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the first time I went there as myself. And it was just like, the audience was so generous, and there was a couple tunes I thought, I've played this better, and it was like a big roar at the end, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to work for that a little more here in New York. I started noticing it when we came back, because there'd be a couple times where I'd think, wow, that was fantastic, and it would be like, you know, the one guy applauding and two people checking their cell phones, you know. And so there is an aspect of like overstimulation here, you know, that sometimes people can take something for granted, and you have to work harder to get their attention.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. But the upside for me was that people got the music, and they still do. And I was a little pigeonholed, and possibly because I was still a younger artist who had less music out. But when I played San Francisco, I remember I made this record called Table for One. It was my third CD, and it was a bit of a departure from the first two. Mm-hmm. And people were still calling it country. And it was so not country. I mean, you know, just no way. And it was like, I don't know. I just didn't know what people were hearing. You know, I can't tell you right now what they were hearing or what they thought. But here, it's like no matter what I do, I feel like the audience kind of gets it. And that's really the upside that New York audiences, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to insult other cities, but, you know, the New York audiences are pretty smart audiences, and that's the upside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's some extra gratification once you've, when you've won over one of those types of audiences, it's a whole nother level of gratification. It really is.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, the other thing is every city has its, I can't think of the word, but exaggerated aspect of itself. And, you know, in, for example, in LA, and this is a bad example, but just to make a point, like maybe like rockabilly, where guys dress up like in the same suits as the 50s, you know, is maybe an LA thing. And I say that with all due respect, because I know some of those guys and they're fantastic, but that ain't happening in New York.
No.
Like that just doesn't fly here. But what will, almost to a fault, is like guys like, you know, detuning their guitars and putting on capos and hitting them with a hammer, you know, or something like real out music happens here. I think more than almost any place I've been. Like that does fly here to a certain degree. And I'm kind of used a really lousy example, but it's helped me, like, and so, you know, I'll rope this in. I just don't want to like say like, yeah, you know, like weird, performance art goes over here. But it allows me to do a lot of things that get accepted. And if it was a college town that was bar centric, my music would be different. Mm-hmm. You'd have to compete with that audience. You'd have to compete with the drinking. You'd have to compete and deliver the expectation. Where here, if I chose to do a backwards loop on my boomerang and play over a drone, people would check it out, you know, because that's an aspect to New York. Do you agree?
Yeah. It's the music is a centerpiece. It's not the... You know, it's not the sports bar mentality. It's, you know, where people are there for the drinks and the hot wings. It's there. It's that the music is the centerpiece.
Yeah. I'm glad you said it in 15 words instead of my 100. But you know, and I really appreciate that too. You know, even though being that gig in Nashville, I still want to go back. I loved Nashville and the scene there, and I knew so many people. You know, every city has its strengths. You know?
Yeah.
And in LA, you can rehearse and you can prepare for a gig. You know, things kind of go on the fly here a little bit, I think. But anyway.
Yeah. No, so. And Nashville is going through a new renaissance, too. They're really, I mean, it's becoming, people are saying it's becoming the next Austin in the sense that it's really opening up its mind to anything that's possible. And that's kind of cool, you know. I mean, you know, especially considering the way country music is right now. I mean, it's not really country music. To me, it's 80s hair metal mixed with hip hop. And,
you know. I know there's good country music out there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, last year I produced with Luca Benedetti. I co-produced with my friend and fellow guitarist who plays on the Honeyfinger record and co-produced that, a record here by this guy, Zephaniah Ora. And it's a really good sounding country record. And because he'd send me sometimes like, oh, I got a good review, and it would be on this blog or and who is dedicated to the kind of country music probably both of us like. At least myself, I really love like 60s country music with a pedal steel guitar.
Yes.
You know, good vocals that aren't too regional, you know, sounding with topics that all men and women could relate to.
Yeah, like,
you know,
and Dale Watson's a great example.
Is a great example,
yeah.
You know, and so it's out there, you know, and but yeah, you know, usually, I mean, gosh, if we turned on America's Got Talent or something like that, and I actually haven't seen that show, but you know what I mean, a Star Search type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's usually like, it makes me feel like a snob. But, you know, it's not the kind of music that, it seems corrupted.
Well, it's
sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it's
a show.
I just think it's
maybe it's great.
I think sometimes it's just backwards. It's just, you know, there, you know, that whole, you know, you got to sing for your supper mentality is no longer there. So, I think once again, you know, like we were saying off air, you know, there's that lack of authenticity, you know, when there is no suffering in the music, in the art. You know, I mean, there's a lot to be said. I mean, I used to love playing the clubs because I was like, oh, wow, this room, you know, you get into a certain room and you'd be like, wow, I can feel the beer, the blood, and the piss in this room. And it just lent to the experience. That's just, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes I'll see an artist, for example, there's a guy I really admire around town named Gray McMurray, who's a guitarist. And, you know, when I see him, I just feel like I see his insides. And sometimes I'll see, let's call this artist Joe. I'll see this guy Joe and I'll think, well, that was really good, but where's Joe?
Right.
You know, and it doesn't necessarily have to be about pain or, you know, I'm miserable. I want you to feel it too. You know, it's just like, well, where's your quirkiness? And, you know, there's certain aspects that, you know, are hiding behind proficiency and a learned vocabulary.
Right.
And that's what I love about Gray. You know, it's the guy's great. You know, he's a legitimate guitarist, but it's like sometimes I almost feel uncomfortable, and that I relish.
Well, think about it though. I mean, like you said earlier, you know, those folks that are doing the Star Search, America's Got Talent type thing, if they were getting, you know, if their shoes were getting wet from carrying their amp, you know, they were walking in the snow, you know, through the streets of New York, and they're carrying their amp and they're carrying their gear, and you know, and they couldn't get a cab, you know, they probably wouldn't do it.
Maybe. I mean, I'd like, I don't know. You know, I agree with your point, but I also think like Nels Klein is, you know, can be a rock star in the band Wilco. And I saw those guys last year. And so they're kind of rock stars, right? I mean, at least to me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, talk about delivering. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I wanted at one point, and I rarely feel this way, I wanted to like rip up my chair and throw it during one of his solos. It was so magnificent, mm-hmm. and violent and real. And, you know, they're catered and they have a tour bus. But nonetheless, boy, talk about, you know, it being real. So I guess, I don't know, you know, it's complicated.
I think they're real because they were that band. Yeah, granted, they've got craft services now and a nice bus, but they were there, and that's the whole thing, is about holding on to your core value. You hold on to your core value all the way through, and you're always going to resonate with your base. It's just how I think that's how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would be, we'd digress if we thought of artists that didn't do that.
Oh yeah, I can think of plenty of those. But you know,
yeah, there might be.
Yeah,
I could think of one, sure, or two that popped into my head. Yeah. But we should use our time for,
yes, positivity. You know, positivity.
And we're saying a name like Gray McMurray that probably a lot of your audience hasn't heard. You know,
right.
But I see your point. I agree.
Yeah. So you've got a new record. It's called Live at Rockwood Music Hall in New York. And this was recorded a lot of shows. And
way too many.
So how in the heck did you go ahead and decide, okay, I'm going to narrow it down to these tracks? How did you do that? That's got to be so difficult.
I hired my staff while I ate craft services. well, Rockwood was kind enough to record every show, almost every show, over a 2-year period. And, you know, we completely would forget that the tape, you know, was rolling.
That's the best.
And we'd do the gig, and every now and then the sound person would give me a envelope of thumb drives, and I'd throw that thumb drives in a bigger envelope here at home. And at one point, you know, I knew when I made the Jim Campolongo Last Night, This Morning record that I was going to follow that up with a live record, because it was so different. Because Last Night, This Morning is a record I'm really proud of, but it's very different in that it's not a trio. There's a guitarist and a steel guitarist and some nice piano and acoustic guitar with Roy Williams and Johnny Lamb, Luca Benedetti. And there's a couple songs in there. I think one in particular, it's my favorite. It's kind of the Like Butter off that record. And it's called, to me, it's different than that, but it's like one I thought, wow, we got it. And it's called Lola, My Baby's Coming Home. And anyway, we did that record. And meanwhile, I felt like Jekyll and Hyde, because on Mondays, you know, we're at Rockwood playing kind of a free rock, if you will, like freeform rock, it almost sounds like to me. And I knew I was going to make that record, but I kept putting off listening to it. And talk about a job, you know. So every morning for, I don't know, a month, I'd go through at least 1 to 2 shows. And when I found something I thought was keeper, you know, they were all like one long recording. I'd separate the tracks. You have to label them so you could find it again. Label the thumb drive. I mean, it was really arduous. And at the end of it, you know, I had a bunch of contenders, and then within that group, I would eliminate the repeats. I mean, in some ways, I could have made a record called, you know, 14 different versions of Jim's Blues. Mm-hmm. You know, I swear there were so many Jim's Blues that I liked. I ended up just asking the bass player, Chris, which, you know, the one he liked the most, I went with, because I kind of liked a lot of them. But I'd have, you know, then those similar tracks would compete with each other. Hmm. And a couple of times I had two versions. Then I went down to the bunker where I recorded Last Night This Morning, the Zephaniah record, and worked with Aaron Nevesi, who's a great engineer, and we went through the stuff, and a couple of them had like, wow, we really aren't getting any snare here, you know, because it was so, they did, the Rockwood staff did a great job, but every once in a while there'd be like, oh, there was a bass on that night, we didn't hear it, but under the microscope of this studio, you know, we hear it. And so a couple tracks got eliminated or versions, and at the end of it, you know, I made a record called Live at Rockwood, and hopefully it's the cream of the crop. Mm-hmm. You know, over a period of 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one track that is literal. There's a vocal track that Josh Dion sings, and that was recorded, I believe, as a one track with one mic. And I like that version so much that we just went with it. And it sounds pretty good. I mean, it sounds really good. And, you know, Greg Calbi mastered it, and Greg remastered Sergeant Pepper's. I mean, he's a great master. He's wow. famous. And so he cleaned the stuff up quite well. And then there was another track with Nels Klein that's 10 minutes long. You know, I really like that. That would have never happened in the studio.
Yeah.
So there was a couple things that I thought, yeah, this is really special. And so, and almost every track I don't think could have happened in the studio. As long as we've been doing this, you know, you go in and you know, there's some kind of recording going on, and it might be noontime, and there's no audience, and you know, sometimes you kind of lean on craftsmanship a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's just kind of wild abandon a lot, or experimentation, and really walking the tightrope and getting, you know, and balancing on one toe, you know. Mm-hmm. And thinking, well, if I fall, it's fine, you know. And so that's why I wanted to release it as well. It's a real good snapshot of what we're up to.
Well, yeah, it's a killer record, I gotta say. And you know, it's interesting, you know, I understand the whole idea of, you know, in a lot with a live record, it's great because you can feed off the audience. They feed off of you. It's sort of this loop, this feedback loop that takes place. So it creates this other type of energy. However, I noticed that, I mean, you guys are so precise and play so well together that there are times when you listen to this record that you go, well, this could definitely be a, you know, this is like, this could be a studio track. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Well, you know, it really makes me happy to, you know, hear you say that, because, you know, I'm so self-critical and think I could have done things better, or I think, oh, I repeated myself a couple of times on that solo just to kind of expand on an idea that mm-hmm. I liked, where I think, is that redundant? Question mark, you know?
Yeah.
For example, on Jim's Blues, the one we picked, I had a blown speaker, but I kind of like it. You know, yeah. I like the sound. I mean, it was like the sweet spot of the blown speaker. The following week, or when the next time I played it, it really didn't sound good. But that night I was thinking, wow, this really sounds gritty. It sounds good. Like, what's up? Like, is there a power fluctuation here in the building? Like, I was thinking like those things. And then I realized I had a blown speaker. Now, you know, so to me, a lot of it sounds raw, to the point of where, you know, I don't want to say embarrassed, but you know, it took some bravery to put that out, because it wasn't every hair in place. And I'm glad you think it sounds really proficient, and I can't deny that Chris and Josh and I have played together at least once a week for 5 years.
Wow.
And then toured, and then, you know, we have gigs in between, and, you know, we're a pretty well-oiled machine.
Yeah, so there's telepathy there too.
There is, and we got some of it. I mean, on that cock and bull story with Mel's client, we changed keys twice in unison. I mean, I hear it and I think, wow, how did we do that? there is a nice gliding aspect to the music. Everybody enjoys.
That is a killer track, I have to say. There are two tracks on this record that have never been released before, and Sal's Waltz and There You Are. And I wanted to talk about There You Are. Once again, that's one of those tracks. When I heard it, I was like, "Wow, this could have been done in the studio." You know, had I not heard the audience before and after the track, I could have potentially not known. That's how it is. But but what's also great about this song, it is absolutely a beautiful melody. And is this an old track or an old tune?
No, it's a new song, and I'm just, you know, for fear of sounding like, you know, overly earnest, I just got like chills. I was so happy you brought that tune up, because first off, that was the first time Nels ever played it, and it was at a show where Nels once in a while comes up and joins us, and we hadn't even decided what he was going to play. But I remember one of the reasons it was good is we had played like four super duper loud tunes before it. And I remember thinking, gosh, I'm really up for a change of pace. Not out of desperation, but it was music to my ears to play something pretty. And that song is a new song. It was actually, I mean, sometimes I have a folder of song titles. Like, I'll think of a title sometimes and think, hey, that's a good one. I'll put it there. And if I write a tune, I'll see if it fits. And but that song was a song I wrote for my fiance, expressing kind of how I felt one day. It wasn't necessarily like, hey, this is for you, come listen to this, you know, but it was just I felt a certain way and wanted to express that, even just to myself, you know. And and we hadn't played it that much. I think we played it once or twice before that, and then on the Nels night, I thought, oh, it'll be great to hear the chords, you know, because it goes to F, you know, it's in D, but it goes to F sharp 7 to B minor. I mean, it's no great, you know, it's not a, you know, giant steps or anything, but there's some chord changes, and it really worked, you know, and I really appreciate that you like it, because it takes some patience, I think, to let it develop. You know, it doesn't really hit you over the head like some of those tunes on that.
Well, yeah, I think the idea with a song like that, you know, and oh God, there's another tune I want to mention too. Songs like that, and songs like, the title track of Heaven is Creepy. I think those are tracks that you have to acquiesce to. You have to let them wash over you, and then when you do, you go, oh, okay. And that's in there. It kind of seeps in, and it's like, wow. After you were done with it, when I heard it the first time, and the band finished, and I heard the crowd, I was just like, wow, that was profound. It was really just such a great. It's such a beautiful song. It really is, which makes me want to ask you about songwriting in general. You know, like,
well,
you know.
You know, I want to say, sorry, I'm so glad you asked me about songwriting, but, you know, at the end of There You Are, there's this really wonderful pause where the audience waits to cheer.
Yeah.
But one of the things that pops into my head, and I don't want to ruin it, is one guy, I don't know where he was, I think he was like 4 inches from the microphone, kind of just went, at the end. And it was so loud, and it ruined the take. I mean, it was like it kind of undermined what had happened. And we spent so much time trying to edit that guy out. It was bleeding into every mic. And if you really listen closely, you could hear them. And we actually created a track that was space and everything else. It was really difficult. And I'm glad it passed the audition, because you didn't say, hey, I really like that track, but what about that guy?
No. And, you know, even that, I mean, I that's so funny, because when you are at a live show and some, you know, somebody who may be a little more greased at the moment, you know, you and they kind of do that. At the same time, you got to say, well, you know what? Somehow he was reached. So
he was definitely reached. I don't know who the guy is, but you know, I ought to charge him an hour of studio time. Anyway, you were going to ask me about songwriting.
Yeah, so about songwriting, you know, if we go back and look at and it is a complete departure record for you in many respects. Last night, this morning record. It's I was writing notes about it. It's like a modernized trip. Through the past, but with an Art Deco vibe, you know. So when
that's
you,
really nice.
When you write, is it for you? Is it how does it start? Is it in your head first, or does it come to you when you're playing?
Well, I wish I could answer something interesting or concrete. I don't know if I'm answering the question, but I usually just sing over some chords that might inspire me. And sometimes I tape that over a specific progression. For example, Lola, My Baby's Coming Home, I did that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it happens so many different ways. You know, I think that there's a tune called Little Song, and I wrote that after hearing Gray McMurray one night, and it's so not like Gray McMurray. I listen to that tune and think, how is that a reply to what I heard? But usually it's some kind of emotional exorcism, you know. When I mean, not to sound like, you know, Joe Art, but you know, when I write a tune, and you know, it's rare, you know, and sometimes I usually try and write songs pretty fast, but sometimes if they take me a few days, you know, I think, well, what's the truth here? Where does it want to go? I mean, I'm not in a big hurry to go to the six minor, you know, or, you know, just, you know, I think, where does this song want to go? And that's always kind of scary, because sometimes if you overthink a tune, you ruin it. You know, it's like, whoops, I overthought it and I lost it. Which, you know, is one of the reasons why I like things that just happen quickly. And as far as it not sounding, you know, like, oh, here's our retro album, you know, I mean, I kind of can't even explain that, other than I think that, you know, we want it to, we have a jazz mentality somewhat, where we want it to sound like now. Like the now moment. So if somebody plays a line, I'll answer that line at the beginning of my solo, for example. That's like an obvious thing. But there's no trying to restructure a certain era, you know, like, okay, I brought my, you know, Gibson Les Paul amp and blah, blah, blah. You know, I just play what I play, and everybody else plays what they play, and we interpret whatever the song is and what it may give us. And I think it's really just based on, you know, a righteous goal of like making the music good and hopefully beautiful, you know. And I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it definitely does. The singing part, the singing over the chords, totally makes sense. That's you're creating a loose structure and something to build on. So that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of times I go back and copy what I say, because a lot of times it isn't natural for me to play the melody in the way I sing it. And there was a tune off a Dream Dictionary that I wrote called The Past Is Looking Brighter and Brighter.
Yes.
And it's kind of the same thing over and over. It's just ba-da-ba-da, ba-da, you know, repeat again and end on a different note. And if I wouldn't have sung that, I would have never, you know, I would have think, I can't, this isn't a song, you know. and yet when I heard it, and not to flatter myself at all, but I thought, oh, this, you know, I was kind of trying to write an aria a little bit. And because I sang it and I copied the phrasing of my vocals, it helped push the tune. And it also brings to mind something a friend of mine, you know, who just passed away, who I so miss, a great musician and great guy named Tim Lenzel, was in my first trio, and he had to get a sub once, and the bassist who was subbing was like, kind of couldn't really grasp what his role should be in the group, which Tim had nailed. And Tim just said, oh man, it's just like Jim's the singer, but he doesn't sing. and in a way, that's kind of what it is. A lot of the songs, like, there is like a vocal like melody, like on Like Butter, not to beat a dead horse, but a lot of the songs are based on a vocal line.
That is absolutely true. I mean, I think that's really why I'm so smitten with your work, in that it's you know, it's always great when you can walk away and hum or sing in, you know, in your, even if it's just in your head, the melody of that particular tune of whatever it was. And in instrumental music, that's really kind of what you hope for, you know. You know, same like with Jeff Beck. Jeff Beck's one of those players that he creates earworms. You do that. You create earworms in people.
Thanks. And, you know, a lot of guitar records don't do that.
No, they don't.
And I don't want to sound high and mighty, but yeah, it's like, yeah, and I don't listen to them, you know, but Jeff Beck, gosh, you know, talk about a guy who just keeps getting better and better.
It's just ridiculous.
You know, I saw a YouTube clip, and I think it was a few years old, and he was playing Sleepwalk. And
yes,
it was incredible. Mm-hmm. And me, as a man in his 50s who's been playing guitar for 35 years or whatever, 40 years, whatever I've been playing, I said out loud, you know, and I was by myself, I just said, gosh, I'll never be that good. And it's like, he's still that good. I felt that way in high school. Mm. But now if I hear some of the guys, not all of them, but some of the guys I liked in high school, I think, he doesn't really play over the changes. You know, let's say Eric Clapton or somebody like that.
Right.
And I love Eric Clapton and I love Cream. And in some ways, my record sounds like Cream. And he's one of my guitar heroes. That said, you know, Clapton doesn't play the major third, you know, and I'll have a sense of being listening back to Cream live when he was a 25-year-old man, and now I'm a guy who's been playing 40 years, and I'll think, oh, I didn't really nail the change here. It's kind of a pentatonic. But with Jeff Beck, I'm just like still in awe of him.
Yeah, well, see, and that's the difference between Clapton and Beck. With Clapton has been and continues to be on a Buddy Guy Freddie King trip. That's his thing, you know, and that's who he channels and how he channels. You know, I always felt that his most original and exciting work was with Cream. But Beck is always pushing the envelope. He's always saying, no, I don't want it to sound like a guitar. I want it to sound like a buzzsaw.
Yeah.
Or I want it to sound like birds, or, you know, sort of like, and same thing like with people like Adrian Belew. Adrian Belew is a good example of that too. You know, it's like, you never know what's going to come out of that guy.
Yeah, you know, that's a guy I kind of, you know, with all due respect, kind of forgot about. And I've seen him live a couple of times. Like, was it the Bears the name of that group he had? Or anyway.
Yeah.
It was really fantastic.
Yeah,
he was very innovative and very vocal and Beck too. I mean, if Beck sounds like a great feminine voice a lot of the times, and the way he uses the vibrato bar and his fingers, you know, you hear the flesh on the strings. It's really amazing, you know. I can't say I have like his latest record, whatever that is, but it makes me want to get it.
Yeah.
You know, just to support the guy.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know, you read interviews and you're like, yeah, do you practice? No, I work on cars.
Yeah.
You know? And I always want, you know what I mean? I think, is that true? You know, because you just keep getting better.
Yeah. That might be the secret to his success, in that he only really plays when it's time for him to get out and do anything live or create new material. And that might be it, actually. It might be that ability. He might be one of those people that, you know, that distance creates a newfound love and a newfound freedom in his creativity. That could be it.
Right, and a different perspective.
Yeah.
But, you know, I read somewhere he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but pretty closely, he said he doesn't practice because he doesn't want to peak too soon. And I swear, I read that, I think, in 1984. You know, and you know, I mean, maybe he's right. You know, but that said, like I personally need to practice.
Same here.
I feel like even if I learn like something that's completely unrelated, I mean, generally I practice things I don't really play in a lot of ways. But if I learn something new, you know, whether it's a little piece on the classical guitar, I feel like I bring that to the next gig I have.
Oh, yeah.
And if I'm not practicing, I feel like I'm not bringing anything. It's mm-hmm. weird. But, you know, I don't know. Jeff Beck's obviously got a bunch of spoonfuls of talent from birth, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe some of us mere mortals have to work harder.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Man. Who knows? Maybe he's an alien.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking earlier about, you were saying actually earlier when we were talking about last night and this morning in the songwriting process about phrasing. I noticed that a lot of times, depending on the track, you phrase a lot like a horn player. So there's that breath element in when you play. Not many players really do that. Is this kind of a conscious thing? Do you realize that? Is it osmosis after listening to Miles for so long? Or
I think it, yeah, maybe. I don't like that whole diarrhea of the notes thing.
Yeah.
You know, to really put it negatively. I mean, unless it's, you know, and like Alan Holdsworth, who I think is utterly fantastic,
mm-hmm.
you know, and sometimes I don't think like he's imitating a human voice, obviously. I really like the one of his older records, Tony Williams' New Lifetime, Believe It.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so sometimes I do like that, but personally, I've listened to a lot of Ben Webster and obviously Miles, and just you know, I really like space. I think to some degree I hold my breath when I am playing, and then I breathe when I'm not. And so, you know, for better or worse, you know, I wouldn't teach that to anybody. But I think it is tied in with my own physicality.
Yeah.
And I also feel like it helps me say something, you know, because that's basically what we're all trying to do. And, you know, and yet, like, again, to go back to Cream, I mean, you know, I listen to Spoonful mm-hmm. probably once a year and still marvel at it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think Clapton really stops. And I think in some ways that created a school that, you know, by the third or fourth or fifth or tenth interpretation of some playing like that, where the first person does it really successfully, maybe the 12th person not so successfully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Let's see, where do I go from here? I've got so much stuff. What was the first record you ever bought? Was it Smash Hits?
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits. You know that. You know, I told somebody a couple of years ago, and they didn't believe me. They said I was trying to be cool, but it's the truth. Yeah, Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits.
Uh-huh.
I really liked Red House.
Yeah.
And the first vinyl I ever bought. I bought singles, and that was Revolution by the Beatles with that that kind of a double stop intro, and it's a slower version. And boy, that used to just make the hair raise on the back of my head, you know. But the first LP I ever bought was Jimi Hendrix Smash Hits with the poster with them on the horses inside, if you remember that. Yeah, that's the first record I bought.
That's pretty trippy. So I know that you have a column in GP, and I read it, and how big is your collection now, your vinyl collection? It must be gigantic.
Well, you know, it's I don't know. I think it's maybe 2,000 LPs, and most of them, you know, are keepers. Like, I'll say that. Like, it's there's not too much fat, you know, in the collection. You know, I don't think I have like Eagles Greatest Hits or whatever, you know, stuff like you can kind of, you know, not to put that down. And some days I want to hear that. I mean, the other day I was like, I wish I had a Journey record with Steve Perry, you know. I really like those guys. You know, I have one Journey record, but it's their first record when they were an instrumental band.
Oh,
Yeah, that was a good band. I used to see them all the time.
Yeah, that's cool. Oh, really?
Yeah, back in the day, we used to go, like, every time. I love them, and I love Neil Sean, and, you know, they'd play Kahotek, and it would be, you know, it was, like, great rock guitar, you know.
Right, so that was with Steve Smith, right? Steve Smith, Greg Raleigh?
No, that was pre-Steve Smith. It was Hensley Dunbar.
Oh, wow.
And they had a rhythm guitarist named, and I hope I'm getting his name right, George Tickner. and it was Neil, you know, who was probably still a kid. And, you know, I was a kid, you know, I was probably, 16 years old. And we used to go see him and just think, wow, you know, I used to love them. But that's the only Journey record I have. But most of the records I have, you know, I have like a big pedal steel collection, and you know, the country music we were talking about. I have a lot of instrumental country music,
like Jimmy Bryant, Speedy West stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. And so I have about 2,000 LPs.
Cool. And so basically, with that, with your column, you just dip in there and pick out an oddball. And because you've turned me on to stuff through that column that I didn't know
really?
About. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but can you remember?
Oh, anything? God. I'd have to look in my iTunes. So what I would do is I'd read it, and I'd be like, oh, that's cool. Let me jump on that and pull it up. And I can't remember exactly now. There was one.
I'm really glad, you know, because it's a couple of times, like, I just, you know, I did Cream Wheels of Fire, you know, and I thought, boy, you know, I even prefaced it with, you know, like an apology for that's what I was covering. But there's one aspect of the column I have to adhere to, and that's that it influenced me. So I can't completely play DJ honestly, you know, but it's funny how many records did that. I there's like a real weirdo, I don't know if it's out yet, now the name's completely escaping me. He's a banjo player, and I want to say Eddie Peabody. That's it. Eddie Peabody plays the banjoline is coming up, and that's really obscure.
That's cool.
It was a record that influenced me. He's like, he invented this electric banjo with a vibrato bar, you know, I think I got the record for like 25 cents and listened to it for, you know, 5 months. And and it started my neck bending thing.
Uh-huh.
And so it has to be done in that context. You know,
right.
I couldn't honestly, I'm trying to think of an example, but like Nirvana's, you know, a Nirvana record that I really like, you know, I couldn't necessarily say, okay, this really change the way I play. I mean, maybe the Sex Pistols, you know, but maybe not them. I try to be honest. I just don't make it up.
Right.
But I'm glad you enjoy the column, and it's really fun to write.
I think
it's
was
really easy.
I think it was, God, Bill Doggett's player, guitar player, Billy Butler.
That's it. I forget that column, actually. I don't even remember writing that one.
I think that's the one.
It's probably Everybody Loves to Honky Tonk. And it's confusing because it's Bill Doggett.
Right.
But his guitarists are Bill Butler and Bill Jennings.
Right.
And that's a great record.
Yeah,
that's the one a friend of mine got the cassette stuck in his car for a
year.
Yeah, that's a true story. And he told me after a year, I'm still not sick of it.
That's great.
That's a great record.
Well, we got to talk about gear because it's, couldn't do this show unless we talk about gear. I would get eviscerated by the audience if I didn't. So, in the last couple of years, you've been working with Han Guitars to create your signature model. How'd that all come about?
Well, it happened. I met Chiho out on Ludlow Street in the Lower East Side one night, and he came up and said, "Hey, I make guitars, and I want you to check this guitar out." And he opened the case it was this really beautiful looking guitar. And the next day I played it on, I think it was the David Letterman show.
Mm.
And with Martha Wainwright.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of started there. And I played that guitar the rest of the tour. And we talked about making a signature guitar, but I had just made the Fender custom shop Campolongo guitar, and there was just 50 made.
Right.
But you know, that was still kind of new, and we talked about it, and this just at the end of this year, you know, the time was right to release what we had collaborated on. And there was a long period where, you know, I thought we'd make this like soup. I mean, it's a boutique guitar, but like this really kind of expensive guitar, you know, that was like, you know, a Stradivarius but new, you know.
Mm-hmm.
and then I think it was my idea, you know, I said, why don't we make a guitar for $800 and call it the Model C, like the Model T.
Mm-hmm.
And Chiho was really into it, but then after about a month he said, it is virtually impossible. I will go out of business if I make a guitar for $800, and like I will be working for negative money, you know. And he was nice about it, but that's basically the gist of it. And so we ended up coming up with a Tele that's $1,495 with a gig bag and free shipping in the U.S. Sorry if I sound like a commercial, or I sound like Escobar. I love that guy. If you remember, if you ever seen his
commercials. Yeah, love his hat.
He'll play like an A minor, and he's like euphorically playing.
Yes.
Like, he literally does House of the Rising Sun, and it's like the most earnest version of House of the Rising Sun you ever hear. But for fear of sounding like Escobar, we are really proud of it. It's a great guitar. I've been playing it. I'm going to bring it to my 55 bar gig tonight, which, you know, is about as good as an endorsement as I can give.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're selling them, and people are buying them, and I think it's a great guitar, and it's at a great price, which I really wanted to do. You know, I just really wanted to look people in the eye and say, yeah, buy this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I feel that and then some, and so does Chiho. We were talking this morning about how delighted we are about it. Sure, $1,495 doesn't grow on trees, but you know, considering what it is, I think it's a great deal, and it's a great guitar.
Well, once again, we go back to that. It's a callback to authenticity, right? I mean, I have a good friend from Colorado, great guitar player, Adam Lopez. He's a great country rockabilly player, and he plays on Telecaster. I don't know if it's your model, but he plays it, and he's had it for quite a while. And the thing is road tested, and it's got all its dings, it's got all its battle scars, and it just keeps coming back for more. So that says really a lot about the guy who builds a guitar, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's made great guitars, you know, long before, like, we collaborated. And as I said, I had that Han, and I played the rest of a tour with it. And, you know, I had to be, like, really on it every night. You know, I mean, it was Martha was, you know, I toured with Martha for a year, and at the end of the year I liked and respected her more than in the beginning, and that was a lot. You know, she's great, and so it was a good working situation. But that said, I used an effects board. I had to recreate the record. You know, it wasn't just be Jim and do your thing. You know, it was like a totally opposite of that. She even told me when she hired me, she's called me up and goes, Jim, you can't be you. And I was like, well, I'll give it a try, you know, the record. But I was using backwards loops and an effects board and all kinds of stuff. And the guitar, you know, had a function, you know, in front of, let's say, a couple thousand people, you know, almost every night. Right. And I used, you know, a guitar Chio gave me, basically. And so, yeah, I think it's the kind of guitar that's going to get better with age, you know, which is what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you're into top loading with your guitars, and you state that it creates a warmer kind of a vibe. And I'm at odds with that a little bit, but only because I've always heard in the guitars that I played that were top loads, they were always kind of a little shinier. Maybe it was the electronics or the way it was set up. But walk me through that.
Well, like most things, you know, and for me, you know, it just started with some naivete. I was looking for a Telecaster, you know, I don't know, this, we're going back 20 years at least. And, you know, I had one and I liked it, but, you know, I wasn't nuts about the neck. Like, it felt a little hard to play. And this student I was giving lessons to every week was a guitar collector. And he brought over that 59 one day. And I mean, this never really happens to me, but I just completely fell in love with it and felt like it was mine. And there was things I could do on it I couldn't have done the day before playing this guitar. And particularly, like, in the middle of the guitar, if I just maybe bore people, but like on strings 4 and 3, I always felt like a bit of clumsiness, and everything fell together on this guitar. And to make a long story short, and it is a long story, the guy ended up his name was John Jensen, gave it to me. And I know at the time it was a 59 Telecaster. It was, what do they call it? Refinished. And, you know, it had new frets. You know, it wasn't a total collector, but it was $2,000, you know, back then. Now, I don't know what they cost. You know, we can't afford them. Yeah. That's what we know.
Yeah,
or
sure.
If we could, we wouldn't spend the money on that. But anyway, you know, which is still substantial. I mean, $2,000 was a lot of money, and he gave it to me. And about 6 months later, there is a point to this story. About 6 months later, I was playing it at a gig, and some guy came up and he goes, "Hey, wow, that's a top loader." And I said, "What's that?" And he goes, "That's you're playing a top loader." And he goes, "Yeah, those are kind of dogs." And I said, "Oh." And he goes, "Yeah, the strings usually go through the back." And the guitar I had before, the strings did go through the back, but I didn't really think about it. I just, you know, thought, "Oh, yeah, I didn't think about it." And I just knew I loved this 59 top loader. So ever since then, I think they were considered more dogs back then than they are now. I mean, you know, even I just got a Duo Sonic, which is like a 3/4 scale style guitar that was made for, like, you know, total low budge and, you know, like your first guitar. And the damn thing feels like a Stradivarius now. I mean, it's an incredible guitar made in 1959. And there's that aspect to all guitars. But I remember, you know, they had a bad rap. So I've been asked about it a lot. And I mean, to me, they just feel a little more slinky. I think the sound is a little more like pleasurable to my ear. I don't like that, you know, glassy steel sound, a glassy telly sound that, you know, kind of punish the audience thing. And I feel like top loaders are just a little, you know, softer and gentler in a way. And you know, I do all this behind the nut bending stuff, and they feel a little looser to me. I mean, I could play both, you know, but I think that, you know, a string through or a top loader. But for that reason, I just prefer the top loaders. And, you know, that's kind of the story behind that guitar.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, that's the 59 is what you're using on the majority of your catalog, right?
Yeah. Yeah, once in a while I'll play, I have a Strat, and if I did an overdub, I think there's some Strat on Heavy, you know, and if I did a record that was multi-tracked, which I think, yeah, I, even on last night, this morning, it was all 59. I mean, you know, it, the thing plays in tune, you know, it doesn't hum, you know, it's, I mean, I have a small guitar collection for sure, but just to keep everything ship shape, you know, and that's amps too.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how many times, I don't know if you've experienced this, you know, you go to a studio and they brag about how many amps they have, and it's like, wow, you have 30 vintage amps that really don't work well, you know? I mean, sometimes I feel like even the stuff I'm using, I have to spray, you know, money through a fire hose at them, you know, to keep the amp working and the tubes new and the speaker crisp. And same goes with the guitar, you know, especially in New York with the weather changing.
Oh, yeah.
So generally, almost out of necessity, I use one or two guitars. But, yeah, I've used the 59 almost on every record.
Yeah. Were you using Princeton's in San Francisco, or was that something that happened when you got to New York and you were like, I got to be as mobile as possible and bring as much power as I can?
Well, a kind of a combination of both. I used a Vibralux for many, many years in San Francisco, and probably used the Vibralux and something else. I used a Deluxe and a Vibralux on the Heavy record, and Vibralux on the three records that preface that, Jim Campolongo and the Ten Gallon Cast, Jim Campolongo and Loose, and Table for One, was all Vibralux. And right before I moved to New York, a friend of mine, Bill Finnegan, who does the Klon Centaur, told me that you should get a Princeton. I think you'll really like them. And a guy I idolize to this day named Bobby Black, who plays pedal steel guitar, and he plays on a Christmas record I made, sold me his, and it has a C10N in it, which is a little more robust than the regular speaker. Mm-hmm. Him being a pedal steel player, he needed it. And I started playing through that, and I loved it. And when I brought it to New York, it was for all the reasons you named, but I was playing the Knitting Factory every Wednesday, and we'd stick a mic on the amp, and it was like, you know, it sounded like the roar of a god, you know, going through the PA. And it sold me. Sometimes I do miss the headroom of the Vibralux, and like how an E string feels, the low E, when you hit it, you know, you kind of feel it in your toes a little bit more, you know. But I think the Princeton has a really sweet sound, especially a really sweet recorded sound. And so I've been just primarily using those, and partially out of laziness too. You know, I've have, you know, a Deluxe I really like. I really like the Deluxe reissue, the first one they made a few years back. When that's backline, I'm kind of like, great, you know, and I get to really move some air, and I get to like control dynamics a little bit more effectively. Like when you're loud or low, it's a little more obvious through a bigger amp, you know. But pound for pound, I mean, I just think the Princeton Reverb, you know, I use two mainly. Like, one is a silver face with a Celestion G10 in it that is all over the two records we talked about, the live record and Last Night This Morning. And then I have that, I still use that Bobby Black amp. I call it the Bobby Black face. That has the C10N in it. It's a little cleaner. I use that on the Willies, for example, and some other recordings. And I may use it tonight with the Han. I want to check out the Han through that amp. Mm-hmm. It's a little cleaner, and the Han Telecaster pickups have a little more output. And I want to see how that matches with mm-hmm. that amplifier. But yeah, basically, yeah, I'm kind of known as like the Princeton guy, you know. And I mean, I'm happy to be known for anything, you know, other than, you know, what maybe O.J. Simpson's known for, or aside from football. And, you know, but yeah, sometimes I do want to bring the deluxe, and then I think, oh, you know, I don't want to bring it up the stairs at 2 a.m. Forget it.
Yeah.
You
know? Hell yeah.
But they're great amps. They're great amps. They have everything you need. They have reverb, vibrato, intensity, and they're loud.
Yeah.
You know, so what else do you need?
Yeah,
maybe
you,
a little bit more headroom.
You tend to you EQ different than most people. Your bass is usually what, about 10?
Yeah.
And where do you what do you keep your treble at?
8. You know, sometimes 7, depending. Like, and it's always some kind of revelation or something. I mean, guitar, I remember amp repair guys would go, "What, are you crazy?" You know, I'd go, "No, I think it sounds better." You know, and and I've been, you know, when I see comments sometimes on guitar, you know, I'll get a Google alert, and it's like, Jim Campolongo puts his bass on 10, you know, like newsflash, you know. And I think, well, it's just, I don't know, I like that, you know. It just sounds fuller to me, you know. And I think everyone should do it, personally. If I play through a deluxe, I don't put the bass on 10, but it'll be high, you know. And I always say, you know, you never say, wow, I wish that Telecaster had more treble.
Yeah, no, you never say that.
You never say that.
No.
You know? So, I mean, if I was playing an ES-175, I don't know. I mean, I have a Gibson 225, and I keep the bass on 10 on the Princeton. I love it. It sounds nice and full to me. You
wow,
know? So,
that's interesting.
And I don't blow, you know, too many speakers. You know, I mean, when I say too many, I mean maybe one. Once a year, I put in a new Celestion G10, but I just like how they sound brand new. To me, when they get really worn in, I kind of miss the brand newness of them. They're kind of perfect, like the first 4 months, and that's like playing them on 10 at least twice a week.
So that's interesting.
Know?
What is it about the new one as far as clarity? What is it that you feel is really does it for you?
Well, it's a little more clear. I mean, there's a really nice creaminess that happens when they get worn in. You know, you get that kind of wall of sound. You know, it sounds like a Gibson through a Marshall more. So,
yeah.
But I kind of miss the ping, you
uh-huh.
know, when you hit a chord and you hear the pick going against different strings.
Right.
That's a little more obvious when the speaker's new. And
right.
The great news is those speakers sound great the day you put them in, to me, you know. And I don't think they're expensive either. And again, I don't want to sound like Escobar. I get no royalties from this, but you know, I've done when I recorded a record called Orange, my amp blew a speaker like 2 days before, and I was concerned. This is when I was new, you know, with the Celestion G10, and I put in one, and it sounded great the first day. To this day, I think, oh, I'm really happy I did blow that speaker, because I had a brand new Celestion G10.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying they sound bad after a year, but they get a little creamier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of tend to like them a little more, where you could distinguish things a little better when I slam down a bar chord.
So you're more lean towards more the Celestion than the Jensens then?
Well, it depends. You know, it depends what I want to sound like. you know, the Celestial sound. I mean, if I have a quote unquote jazzy gig, I'll use the Celestial because it's a little more, it's a little less bright. If I want more brightness and clarity, I'll use, you know, the Celestial C10N speaker, which those things cost a fortune now. I did a Google search; they're like $300 or something like that. You know, they're a lot. You know, but I think it's those sound really nice, but not as overdriven. A little more clarity, and as I said, you know, they still break up, but it isn't like Marshall-esque. So depending on what the situation calls for, but mostly I lean to the Celestial.
Cool. Interesting. Let me jump back around. I want to jump around your catalog just real quick, and then I know you got stuff to do. I want to let you go. I want to hold you all day, but there's a track on American Hips, and this is an album I don't think really gets a lot of attention, and it should, called Between Your Toes.
This
is another one of those songs that just kind of, whenever I was saying earlier, it kind of rolls over you. It's that seepage. It kind of just gets in there. It fills all the nooks and crannies in your soul. That's one of those tracks, Between Your Toes. Can you tell me about that session, if you can remember back that far?
Well, no one has mentioned that song to me in like the last 10 years. It's funny. But yeah, I really remember that session because I had moved to New York and I had a little bit of cushion. I forget. I'll just name it. I'll tell everybody my finances at the time. Yeah, I think I had $8,000. And, you know, New York City isn't a, you know,
go through that
place
quick.
To live.
You burn through that quick.
You can spend $8,000 on a weekend and start taking cabs.
Hell yeah.
And so I thought, okay, well, you know, I think I could stretch that to 6 months. And anyway, so I came here and at, I think it was 3 or 4 months, I recorded American Hips, and it was, you know, I still had $8,000, I think. And so it was, there was a sense of urgency I cannot describe to you, like, you know, financially and musically. Like, I was like, oh God, like, whatever happens, I have to release this, like, so it better be good. And we recorded it, I did with Dan Reeser and Tim Lentzel, and the day before I got food poisoning.
Oh no.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure, but I know my landlord was, he had this poison powder. There was like mice and he was like putting it all over the apartment. And I think I got it from that. But anyway, so we had 3 days booked and I missed one day with food, you know, with like food poisoning basically, or just poisoned. I don't know. So we had 2 days to record the record, and you know, it really came out well. Like, I don't know how, but it did. And we got a great sound, you know, and you know, the other day I was vacuuming or something and I had iTunes Shuffle on and I heard this track and I thought, wow, who is that? I like this. And I was like, is that Mark Ribot? And I turned off the vacuum cleaner and I listened to it for another 5 seconds. I'm like, oh no, that's me. and it was Jim's Blues off I haven't heard it in so long. I mean, forgive me if I sound full of myself, but I thought, wow, that was really good.
Yeah, no, I think that's marvelous when that can happen.
And that's the Bobby Blackface amp, too.
Ah.
You know, Between Your Toes, I remember just Tim Lentzel really bringing that tune alive. And it's such a understated piece. Sometimes even I need the approval of others, you know, because I'll think, I did that with, there's a tune I wrote called Blues for Roy off Orange.
Yes.
And I know it's one of the more popular songs off that record. And I thought, you know, I don't know, is this a tune? It's just a blues, you know. And the bass player at the time, Richard Hammond, just said, hey, Jim, that's a good tune. And that was all I needed. You know, yeah. I mean, I'm easily positively reinforced, I guess. But, you know, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll keep playing it. You know, and sometimes I don't like that about myself. You know, maybe there's a good tune and I should show some toughness. But if somebody said, man, that's not a very good tune, I probably would never play it again. But Tim was really supportive about Between Your Toes. And I think it's really vibey. And that whole record is, I mean, it's got the track American Hips. And the happy ending is, I think it was, I can't remember the name, like CGI or somebody like that. One of those big investment bankers that went out of business in 2008 used American Hips as on their commercial with Tommy Lee Jones.
Wow.
Doing the voiceover. And I didn't make millions, but I made some money. And you know, it was like the weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders. I forget the name, like CGI, something like that. Some big, and like not Merrill Lynch, but one of those.
Right.
And they went out of business in 2008. But this was before 2008. I forget. I think that was American Hips was released in like, I don't know, 2002 or 3 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that record, and Norah Jones is on it doing Sweet Dreams. You know, I cannot believe everybody basically almost worked for free. Tony Scheer, we recorded Sweet Dreams at his studio. I don't think he charged me. You know, it was, you know, we're getting back to New York, I guess.
Yeah.
And the kind of support I got, and look, I wasn't the most talented person that I've just named. It wasn't like, you know, here's a, you know, I mean, people were, you know, they recognized I was trying to be good and trying to do something of value, and they supported that. That was another reason why American Hips was possible.
Yeah. So that's that. There goes that adage, and I'm a firm believer in that adage, is that you never be the best guy in the band because there's nowhere for you to go.
So that's so true. It's so true with Chris and Josh, too. I mean, some of my freer playing and everything, they're so supportive. You know, there is never a dirty look in that band.
Yeah.
You know, you could lose one and mess up the AABA form.
Uh-huh.
No dirty looks. It's okay. You're going for it. We support that.
That's great.
Yeah.
So another record that I want to talk about is Heaven is Creepy, which is another really great record. And there's, you know what? I listen to that record and I go, man, you could use most of the tracks on this record to put in a movie. Like Mr. and Mrs. Mouse. That is like movie soundtrack music. Menace, such a great track for a movie. You know, and the title track, of course, is haunting as hell. What was that session like for you?
Well, you know, I really appreciate that. And I forgot about Menace. And I love that song.
Crazy track. That track is insane.
I think it should be on a movie.
Yeah.
And that was recorded on I used a Vibrochamp on that track, too. And it really sounds, I don't know, big.
It's gigantic, yeah.
You know, Heaven is Creepy is such a solid record, and it has a monkey in a movie and the prettiest girl in New York. Like, I think like over the long run it became popular, but considering there's some hits on there, you know, for lack of a better word, that I still play, you know, I don't think it like hit the guitar world by, you know, storm, nor did it get like a million good reviews or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a disappointment, but it was kind of went totally under the radar. But not every day, but people kind of talk about it to me, you know, which makes me feel really good. Like it hasn't died. But it wasn't the most fun record to make because we had recorded a record with a well-known producer, and it was very much like Heaven is Creepy. But we really couldn't ask. I did something kind of naive, and you know, we just kind of assumed like business deals instead of talking about them. Mm-hmm. And after we recorded, you know, it was like the business deal wasn't really acceptable, which was kind of heartbreaking because this guy was really in our corner and really supportive. And I know he meant well, but I think in some ways, I don't know what year it was, let's say 2004 or five, there were still remnants of big music industry and labels. Mm-hmm. And that kind of mentality. And, you know, it really wasn't applicable anymore. And the agreement was, you know, we just couldn't come to an agreement. And so we had to can the record. And then maybe 6 months later, I had some new tunes. I actually hadn't written Heaven Is Creepy yet. Heaven Is Creepy wasn't on the record that got canned. And there was a few songs on there. Maybe half the record wasn't on Heaven Is Creepy. And I was kind of conscious of that because I didn't want to go re-record everything and then, you know, make this guy mad, you know, because mm-hmm. he had invested some money in the recording. You know, it was real... You know, it was a real political business situation. And so a couple of the tracks we had recorded, so it was like we had kind of been there, done that a little bit, you know. But that said, it really helped us. It was like the record that got canned was like a pre-production exercise, you know. And you could hear what you'd want to do differently and what you thought maybe could do better. And in a couple of cases... There was a tune on the canned record called Tony Mason that yes. I named after a drummer here that was amazing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't release it, really. You know, so there was, you know, it was like you'd never repeat it performance, you know. And so when I made Heaven Is Creepy, that was kind of hovering. That taste was still in my mouth a little bit. But it ended up being a really good record. And like a lot of records, I'm sure everyone who's listening who's made a record, a couple of years pass and you finally can hear what it is and you end up liking it, you know. I mean, I'm so uncomfortable after I make a record. I didn't feel that way after Last Night This Morning, funny enough. I really love that record. Like, I listen to it more than any record I've ever made. But most records, and probably because they're trio records and there's so much focus on me, I feel uncomfortable, where the Honey Fingers record was such a collaboration mm-hmm. that, you know, if I thought, oh, I could have done my solo better, then Lucas starts playing and I think, God, that's magnificent. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the story of Heaven Is Creepy.
It's a cool record. I really dig it. Another record that I want to talk about, I mean, honestly, I think we should do an episode where we actually just go through every single record. But Orange.
I'm enjoying this. I forget about some of these songs you're mentioning. So it's great.
So Orange, the Orange record, the track that opens up the record is called Back Burner. It speaks to the little rocker boy inside me. I love that track. It's just, I want to break furniture when I hear that song.
Yeah, it's, I got to say, I that one, we really got it. And talk about, like, pushing a boulder uphill. Like, and that was the toughest track on the record until it ended up being incredible. So I don't want to bore you or talk too long or whatever, but I'm happy to. Okay, we recorded so many basic tracks of that, and for some reason none of them sounded good. Like, we just couldn't find a good basic track. I mean, the band was great, but it just wasn't happening, or I'd make a mistake or something, you know. It just, they didn't have it, or it sounded flat. And we had recorded so many versions of it. It was like we tracked for 3 days, and every day we'd do, like, you know, we'd nail everything and then do like three versions of Back Burner, you know. And at the end of the 3 days, you know, we had a couple weeks before overdubs, whatever overdubs we had. And you know, we were like, we don't have Back Burner. We never got it. And I don't know why, but I went through everything again, and I found this one track. It was like on day one, take two or something, you know. And I called the producer, Anton Fear, and I said, hey, I found a good basic track, but I'm really screwing up. Like, I didn't, you know, this one was totally my fault. And I go, do you think we can, you know, we recorded basically live. I said, was there enough separation, like, where I could just redo it? And he said, I'll check it out. So we went in and checked it out, and it ended up that you couldn't hear the guitar. So I could overdub it. Okay, so I went in and it was like, okay, today, you know, we have to do 25 things. And the first thing is play great on back burner. And I said, okay. And I went in and I was playing horribly. It went from okay to pretty good to bad to like, okay, I'm embarrassed. Like, and Anton was getting really impatient, and that didn't help because we had 25 other things to do. And I was just, it's like a nightmare, right? Like, you're just there and like you're just failing miserably. And so we just skipped it, okay? And we went on and did the other 25 things. And the story is so long. So the third day, we were going to mix, and I said, you know, we never got back burner. And he's like, yeah, well, we tried, you know. And I said, well, let me try one more time. And there was this guitar there that was a thin line Telecaster that had like 11s on it that was sitting in the control room. And gosh, I credit the guy on the record, and Nicky, oh, I can't remember his last name, but he's credited. And there was an amp there, and the engineer, the guy who owned the studio, and I can't remember his last name either, just because I'm, you know, lame, but his name was Matt. I can't remember. He's a great guitarist, too. He had this amp, and it was plugged into the amp that was in the control room. And I said, I'll just play this. Like, let me try and play backburner one more time on this equipment. And I nailed it. And the amp was something like, I said, what is that amp? And I never saw it, like, because I was in the control room and the amp room was like two rooms away, right, in the studio. And I've never seen the amp. But I saw Matt. I go, hey, Matt. I go, and I don't know if this is true or I don't, you know, audience, this may be a lie, okay? But I go, how much is that amp? It sounds fantastic. He goes, it's $50,000.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I go, you're kidding. He goes, no, I made it myself. And he goes, Joe Satriani has one. And I said, well, whatever it is, it sounds fantastic. So that's the story of Backburner. And I'm telling you, it wasn't easy, but it just all worked out. And I got to say, like, that's, you know, not everything on all my records is like what I think is like, yeah, you know, like, right, like what the Beatles did on every track, you know, and you don't know how they did it. Like, you got to rush through it. You got to take what you can, you know, you got to compromise. But Backburner's like, wow, we nailed it. And I love the sound, and it was a thin line with incredibly heavy strings through an amp. I can't tell you anything about it other than he told me it was $50,000.
That is hysterical. I can't believe that it wasn't your gear at all. That's amazing. I love that.
Not at all.
I love, so, you know, so here it is. It's like you got thrown into a situation that, you know, it was you were in unknown territory, and the angst of trying to get this song done so many times, I guess that's when the universe just aligns, I guess. It's just, that's incredible. That's great. What a great story.
I guess it is. I'm glad it was a long story, so I'm glad it's not boring. I mean, and to be honest, like, I love playing through stuff that isn't my 59 through a Princeton. I mean, every time I do, I'm like, wow, this is incredible. It's like, sometimes I feel like I'm eating the same thing every day, and all of a sudden, you know, you're eating a hamburger, and you've been eating a tuna salad every day for 5 years, and this hamburger is like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever eaten. And I had that feeling when I played through that thin line Telecaster with like super heavy gauge strings, because I do a bend on the low E and I bend up a whole step, which is usually no problem. Yeah. But I remember, and it's no problem on tens, and it starts to be problematic on 11, you know, like an 11 set.
Yeah.
And I could barely get it up a whole step. And yet the harmonic I hit like screams out.
Yeah.
Because of how of the setup. So it really was great, you know. That's, it really worked out
super cool, super cool. But now that Live at Rockwood Music Hall is out for the world, for all their, for the naked steaming ears of the planet, what's next?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, right now I'm still kind of pushing the record.
Mm-hmm.
And involved with Chiho. We're talking kind of in theory about if we're going to make like a different kind of model than the Han Model C, but we're totally getting ahead of ourselves, you know, because we still feel like this is a year plan and we have to see how it goes.
Sure.
I want to go to Nashville again and hang out there for a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the agenda. I'm getting married this summer.
Ah,
yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. We seem, the trio, getting back to music, you know, we've been playing Minneapolis, then Chicago, then Nashville, and we did really well in all cities. And we play in Detroit once a year, and I'm trying to string together a little tour, you know, that'll be at least all those cities. But it's tough. Like if I got an Indianapolis date, that would be great. But there's like one club I know of in Indianapolis, and they haven't returned my email. But I'm trying to string another tour together. We're still playing Rockwood. I'm considering not doing it every week and doing it every other week.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, I am thinking about making another record, and I'm writing for it. I'm not sure what that record's gonna be. Part of me might want to do a record. I don't know if I should say this because I won't do it. It'll seem like, you know, what was he thinking? But of like some standards.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe with my band, of course, Josh Dion and Chris Morrissey, maybe with Nels Klein. I also would like to do a duet record with Luca Benedetti. You know, I really wish I could make three records a year. But
mm-hmm.
I've been messing around, you know, with Round Midnight for about 4 years, and I'm finally starting to get it. And I do In a Sentimental Mood, and I've been doing Light Blue, which is by Thelonious Monk. And I'm thinking, well, it'd be interesting to do a record of standards, but played, you know, kind of Telly-esque. You know, something a little different, or solo guitar, something, you know, that... I mean, this will be my 13th record, and, you know, there's a few things I can do. I'm certainly not Lenny Bro or Charlie Hunter, but, you know, that might, you know, be different, and an aspect of my musicianship that maybe isn't as heard and will scare me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure, it's scary to go out and play Round Midnight after you hear Wes Montgomery do it, you know, but hopefully my take on it will be valid and challenging. So, you know, that's kind of what I'm thinking as far as this year. And if I'm forgetting anything, I can't think of it now.
Yeah. I love the idea of the duo record. That's really interesting.
Huh, because me and Luca have been playing duo, and it's really taken a life of its own.
I believe it.
Yeah, we were kind of uptight the first part of the first gig.
Well, you're both so different. You're so different from each other, so I think
yeah,
that...
but it became really loose, like, and we kind of marveled at it. One song we did Autumn Leaves, right? And it just took this life of its own where... You know, there was total interplay. I'm not saying it was like Jim Hall, Bill Evans, you know, that record, but, you know, it was in the spirit of that a little bit, where it was like interplay as well as support going on at the same time. Like, it was almost like no one was being lead. Mm-hmm. There was like two leads. And I would like to investigate that more. We have a gig next month, and it's a three set gig, so we can really get inside it. I need to get a little better at it, you know. But we're on to something good, you know, that just isn't you play rhythm, I play lead, I play rhythm, you play lead. You know, yeah. It's starting to turn into something special.
Cool. That sounds really intriguing. I'd like to hear that. That'd be cool. Very neat. Well, Jim, I mean, I could go on forever, man. I can't thank you enough for taking the time out to talk to me and all my listeners. This has been truly something, a dream realized for me to do this interview. It's really special for me. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, it was for me, too. I'm smiling and, you know, talking to you made my day. I just hope it wasn't, you know, too long.
No, it's wonderful. This is exactly what we love. This is, you know, you made my job a whole lot easier, too, I got to tell you. You know, it's I was talking to one of our blog writers the other day, and he's a great rock and punk guitar player. I love him. His name is Adam Hunt, good buddy of mine. And I was saying that I was going to do this interview, and he was like, oh, that's fantastic. I said, yeah. I says, I really love the way he plays. I said, you know, all of his records are sonic portraits. And I said, you know, he's like the Picasso of the Telecaster. and my buddy Adam just said, he goes, that's it. That's exactly who he is.
Wow. Well, tell Adam I said thank you, and you too. You know what?
I want that to be a quote in the world. That yes, Jim Campolongo is the Picasso of the Telecaster.
Well, I'll use that quote if it's okay.
Go right ahead.
That's really nice. Thank you.
Well, once again, thanks again, and you know, keep in touch with us. Let us know when stuff's going on. We'd love to have you on again, and you know, when you do whatever the next project is, come on here. We'll do a track by track, and we'll dissect the record.
That sounds great. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. You have a great rest of your Sunday, and I'll be in touch.
Okay. Thanks a lot. You have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
out Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, and Tumblr, and of course, on guitarradioshow.com.